This is Oral History 800. This is card number 4, recorded on the 8th of February 2007. Alison Murchie continuing the interview with Silver Moon. And we were talking before we started the interview today, and we've decided on a title which will be self-explanatory. It's Men, Motorbikes, Marriage and Turning Lesbian. So I think from that array, let's start with motorbikes and where your passion from that started.
Well, I suppose I probably got some of that just from my family. Like, my father had actually been a motorcycle racer. He had used to race bikes on Rolly Park Speedway when that existed.
For those that don't remember, can you tell us where Rolly Park used to be located?
In Bowden, Brompton. And I went there as a child. I don't actually remember a lot about it. There was a lot of dust, dirt, shouting, lights. But my father had I think it was about a 1908. He had this amazing motorcycle. It was a BSA, and it had no brakes because it was a speedway bike and a little tank. And it was pretty, pretty cool. So he had that. But my mother, I think when my parents were courting, my mother had been on the back of Dad's motorbike, and she fell off on the corner and hurt her outfit and stuff. And she was a bit sus about motorbikes after that. And my second eldest brother, Alan, the one that used to, everything happened to Alan, he, of course, had a motorcycle and crashed it and nearly died and things like that. So at some point, I bought a motorcycle, and I'd waited for an adequate amount of time for things to have been forgotten. And
how old were you when you got your first bike?
My first motorcycle was, it was 1974, so I was
22.
And I bought it brand new, which I thought was pretty good. And although I had actually had a fair bit to do with motorcycles before then, with friends and with boyfriends. And
Well, tell me the important thing. What sort of motorbike was it?
the one I bought was a Honda CB175. So, something I could afford and something that I could physically pick up off the road if I crashed it, which I realised was important, having hung around with boys with rather large sort of stupid machines. But I must admit, when I had a series of boyfriends, there was one, this is a little story with motorcycles. I had a boyfriend, Andy, who had a CZ175, and I decided to get rid of Andy and take up with another guy, and he had a BMW 750. And I can remember Andy remonstrating about this and accusing me of, going to a boyfriend just because with a better motorcycle, just because of the better motorcycle. And I was about to sort of, reply back, that there's no way that I'll do that, when I closed my mouth and I thought about it.
And he was right.
And I thought, perhaps a BMW 750 was certainly preferable. So I had quite a little bit of a motorcycle focus there. And getting my own was really great, and I actually did a lot of travelling on my little one. I went to Queensland twice.
Did you travel by yourself or with a group of...?
Mostly by myself, occasionally with somebody else. But it was just, there's no way I could have afforded a car.
So tell me about the trip to Queensland by yourself. That's a fairly daunting adventure let alone on a motorbike.
Yeah, that's right. And also, I didn't have a lot of money in those days, so I didn't really have leathers or anything, so I'd get quite cold and whatever. And, buzzing down the highway on a tiny motorcycle, riding to Queensland is a bit funny.
Did you have any problems?
The gusts of wind when big trucks went past, that was quite dangerous. But I used to kind of smile because I'd be buzzing down there and you'd see a single light coming the other way and motorcyclists kind of nod to each other or, lift a finger or whatever. And it would be somebody on some, black and chrome monster who would nod to me before they realised I was this little buzzing thing. But, it got me around the place, which was great. And, I always worked on it myself, and I don't think at that stage I would have trusted anybody to...
Did it give you a sense of freedom as well as that adventure?
Yeah, it did, and I certainly did do a lot of stuff driving much too fast or dangerously for a bit, but not too much.
And in those days, I don't think helmets were even compulsory, were they?
They were, but below a certain speed, it wasn't compulsory. And of course, it was a while before things like full-face helmets came in. And I certainly did crash my motorbike once and end up in hospital, which was...
What were the circumstances of that?
A black dog jumped out in front of me in the middle of the night, which was one of those unavoidable things. And we both crashed together into the road. And then I think the dog died, but I wasn't sure, and I ended up in hospital. And then later on, the next time, you know, I rode my motorcycle, having fixed it up and having fixed me up.
Were you seriously hurt?
I smashed my glasses into my face, so that wasn't very good. And I also had broken my collarbone, but I didn't tell them at the hospital about that. They didn't notice, and I didn't tell them I was trying to get out as quick as I could. But, so that was a bit difficult. I had people picking bits of glass out of my eyes. And I had bandages over my eyes for a while. And it was interesting to finally take the bandages off and then actually look at my face, because it looked a bit different to how it used to. But, But the next time I rode my motorcycle...
You weren't scared to get back on your bike?
I was a little bit, so I made a point of doing it fairly soon. And then I went riding down the road and a black dog jumped out in front of me again. So, but I didn't crash into it that time.
And have you maintained your interest in motorbikes? Do you still ride, or have you over most of your
life? I've actually got a quad bike because I live on a farm now, so I've actually got a Honda quad bike, so I've sort of gone...
Moved up a little bit in size.
Well, it's changed form somewhat, but yeah.
Is it an interest you have maintained over the years in motorbikes, even if you haven't necessarily owned one?
To a degree, yeah. At one stage I used to, you know... Yeah, it's more about the people that you know. And, like, we have a bloke that works in the vineyard who owns Harley Davidsons and Honda Gold Wings and things like that. So, but one of the nice story about my motorcycle was when little Fiona, who I was caring for, she was about five, and I lived in a communal household, and I decided to take my motorcycle completely apart because I needed to rebuild the engine. And so I took it completely apart and I had it on my bedroom floor. And the toddler that we had in the house, he was around, so it was a little bit of a worry. But finally, when I put the motorcycle back together, there was one piece missing that he'd appropriated. But little Fiona was very interested in the fact that the men of the household kept on saying, there's no way it's going to work, you know, you don't know what you're doing, whatever. And little Fiona and I were this little team, and I knew perfectly well it was going to work fine. But I made a point of, you know, just taking Fiona on this little path where, you know, we were working on the bike together and I'd be telling her about how I worked and whatever, and she'd be handing me things, and then, you know, I kick it over and of course it goes, it's fine. And that was a really nice thing to do with her.
Where had you learnt your mechanical skills? From your father?
Yes, and just through my own sort of interest, really. As soon as I had anything to do with any vehicles, I was either helping my brothers or boyfriends or whatever.
Well, you'd said earlier that you only trusted yourself to look after it, so you obviously
I wouldn't have
knew what you
it.
Were doing.
Oh, well, up to a point, yeah, there's always things. And I liked figuring it out. I knew more about cars, actually, than motorcycles. So one of the things that I liked about taking mine completely apart was actually to look at actually how the gearing mechanism and the synchro sort of worked. And that sort of thing. I like knowing how things work.
Money aside, was there an ultimate bike motorbike that you would have liked to have had?
Oh, I actually had a sort of share for a while in a Ducati 750 Supersport, which was kind of like the preferred one.
And that would fly.
That would fly. And also it was Italian, so it was built for a smaller person. So it was a good one for women to ride. Yeah.
You had no ambitions for a Harley?
No, I didn't actually. But and one of the things about a motorcycle is that when I, you know, was starting to focus a lot on environmental work, I didn't really want to be using a lot of petrol, so I, you know, would either be taking public transport or I'd take my bike. Yeah.
Okay, enough about bikes for today. I think it's time we moved on to men. You mentioned earlier that quite a few of your boyfriends had motorbikes, and that was part of the attraction. Yeah. But you still got married quite young, didn't you? Can you tell me the circumstances?
Oh, no, it was the same year I bought my motorbike, actually.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's
I remember.
Still relatively young, in your 20s. Can you talk about your boyfriend and then future husband and how you met and tell me that story?
Well, I mean, it's funny from the point of view that I now realise I am a lesbian. And
we'll get
obviously
to that shortly.
Lost one then. And so I think probably looking back, I might see different things to some other people. But and certainly I went through a myriad of boyfriends, and I never thought, because I guess I was brought up in the 50s, I didn't know anything about lesbianism, so it wasn't an option. Being a lesbian wasn't
probably
an option.
Probably hadn't even heard the word in the 50s.
That's exactly right. And so it's not like I was looking at men thinking I was a lesbian and trying
You were
out.
Looking at men thinking this is what I have to do,
that's
because
exactly
this is
what
the
I
way
have to
life
do.
Is.
Yes. And also a lot of the clues that you could get, we'll see a lot of heterosexual women have a lot of difficulties with men and often don't like them much, so it doesn't actually help, doesn't give you a clue as to what you're doing. But when I look back now, I think I sort of, I had an interest in men with motorcycles, and beards.
And that really was the attraction.
Well, not necessarily. No, I had a
perfectly nice... Well, you actually liked them as
nice...
people, okay.
Yeah. Oh, you wouldn't bother otherwise. And certainly when I did meet Peter, who I married, he was, if I was going to be married and have my partner, he was a good choice. He was smart. He was politically acute. That's what I wanted. He understood about personal politics, so... when we talked about women's liberation, ultimately when we were married, he did his own washing, he cooked half the meals, which is a bucket loads better deal than
so
most
women. So why wouldn't you marry someone
even
like
now.
That?
Yeah, that's right. But essentially we ended up being married more because of his parents' pressure than anything else.
Before we get to that, just tell me how you met.
I worked for a bit over a year in the Department of Veterans Affairs, which is where he was working. And at that stage, Veterans Affairs had been policy to preferentially employ World War II ex-servicemen. So there was a large proportion of World War II ex-service men, and I emphasise the men, there were hardly any women at all. And then just as we joined was when they were sort of starting to retire. So there was this odd little collection of those of us who were younger, so you kind of stuck together. Because it was an extremely conservative place. But it was interesting politically in that while on the one hand I'd been doing a whole lot of stuff about opposing the Vietnam War, one of the things that I was doing in the Department of Veterans Affairs was seeing the first Vietnam vets come in the door with all sorts of bizarre and horrible problems that they often didn't know how to even describe, which was from chemical damage and so on. And
as well as the emotional problems, were they important to them at that stage?
Not so much.
I can certainly understand the Agent Orange and some of those toxic things, but I don't think they would have really been.
Well, they were treated appallingly, actually, by the department, and that was partly because a lot of the World War II ex-servicemen just didn't see them as being in a real war. And so those of us who were younger, if we saw someone youngish coming in the door, we leapt out to the front counter, even if it wasn't your job, in the hope of sort of getting in the way of some people who weren't going to be treating them very well. So that was a kind of interesting aside. And Peter was one of the ones who saw that as I was seeing it, and he was also trying to help people. And we were getting a bit of a better idea of what, had been going on and was going on in Vietnam.
So I can see why you were attracted. You obviously had a lot of issues in common, and obviously he was the sort of person that you could share those things with.
Yeah, that's right. And certainly... this is in the middle of women's liberation stuff happening and whatever. So we had a lot of things to debate about and whatever. But, Peter was politically cluey.
So why did you decide to actually get married? Because certainly a lot of people in that time fell in love and ended up together without the marriage certificate.
It was mainly his parents. you know, who, and they actually disapproved of me, so you'd think, why would they be pressuring
me? Do you know why they disapproved of you?
I was the wrong class. He was a nice middle-class boy. I was a working-class girl. No, they didn't like me at all.
What about your parents? What did they think of him?
No, they actually liked Peter. They thought he was a good lurk, and they were incredibly disapproving when we split up. So it worked kind of both ways. But no, we stupidly, I think, thought that if we got married, it wouldn't make any difference and it would just shut his parents up. And of course, it does make a difference. Even though we continue to live in a communal house, it didn't make a lot of difference to him, but it made quite a big difference to me.
Why was that?
Because people treat married women completely differently to single women. And
you better explain that.
Well, it's just a societal thing. You're perceived differently. And a lot of friends I had stopped being friends or changed the way they acted with me.
What, you'd fallen in their estimation because you were now a married woman?
No, I probably had ceased to be a potential partner for some. I mean, I'm probably looking back a bit cynically.
No, but there's obviously reasons why people change their attitude towards you when you get married. I totally agree with you, and I'm just trying to explore
why. But it was interesting that given that I was living in a sort of communal household and, you know, people ostensibly have more progressive views, in actual fact, people's views of me changed because I was married, those who knew I was. And I found that quite interesting.
But they didn't change their attitude to him?
No, not noticeably, which was interesting.
So how did you handle that?
Oh, I argued a lot, probably. I don't really remember now. but so that was an experiment for me, and at this stage I still have no clue about actually being a lesbian.
All right, so what was married life like? I mean, it's fairly, okay, living-wise, I mean, you were living in a share house and to some degree... Yeah. Your life would have continued as normal with your feminist activities and things and work and things like that. But how did they change? What things changed in your life?
As far as being married, it's hard to say really what goes with what. In actual fact, when I look back, Peter was more conservative than me. He was a sort of hack worker for the Labor Party. And so I learned a lot about the Labor Party.
Had you had any involvement with the Labor Party up until then?
Not specifically.
Other than perhaps just your regular voting things and stuff like that.
And going to odd meetings and stuff. I used to sort of check out everybody, really. So I learned a lot about the internal workings of the Labor Party, which wasn't necessarily good. And at one stage I also lived in a household with a bloke who worked for the Liberal Party in a similar sort of way. And so I guess I developed fairly early a strong antipathy to both of the major parties just by looking at the difference between what they said and what they did.
When you said that they were both hack workers, do you mean that they worked as volunteers rather than paid office staff? Or what was their job as a hack?
Yeah, they were... Well, Peter, for example, was the treasurer of Young Labor. And because he was... got called on to sort of do things. He
more honorary paid. Roles rather than paid by the party.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
But he certainly did a lot of work.
But very committed to what they were doing. Yep.
Yeah, that's right. And it's hard to describe. But in fact, I knew marriage wasn't for me from the beginning. In fact, from the day we got married.
All right, tell me about the wedding day. That must have been fun.
Well, I had a lot of friends come to see me in a dress.
That was quite a novelty. I did a nice traditional white dress.
No, I got a rainbow coloured skirt from Myers, I think it was. Cost $30. And whatever.
But it was a dress. I was trying.
I can see why his parents didn't like me at all. But my
church wedding?
No, in the registry office.
And so that would have been a point of objection from his family as well? If they were traditionalists,
they weren't particularly religious. So I don't think that would have been a big bother. But the thing that I do remember is my little niece, Carol, was a sort of flower girl. And I'd made her, she'd wanted to be a flower girl, so I'd made her some silver jewellery to wear and I'd made a little blue dress for her. And we're going through the process that you go through to get married and the guy that married us, he was actually a little bit drunk. And was making kind of like slightly out left of centre jokes that weren't actually terribly funny. So it was kind of a bit of a weird thing. Anyway, we go through stuff. And at some stage, I bend over and I say to Carol, now we're married, you know. And Carol had obviously, she was only about 5 or 6, she obviously had some notion of what marriage might be in her mind, and whatever we'd just done wasn't it. And she looked up, and it was a moment of silence in the room for some reason. She looked up and she said, "Is that all?" in this little voice. And I looked at her and I thought, I've done the wrong thing.
You knew then.
I knew straight away I'd done the wrong thing. But, you know, it's too late then. Yeah. And for me, I found it very interesting, or it's interesting looking back, you know, that I was involved in a whole lot of women's liberation stuff. Some of which at that stage, I mean, it was fairly early in second wave feminist theory, but, you know, there was a whole lot of debate about what the meaning of marriage was. And I think in some ways it was useful that I actually did it to actually get to know what it was like, because I felt like that in the 4 years that I was with Peter, I was becoming less and less myself and more of a sort of effective zombie.
All right. You've said you just realised straight away that you weren't meant to be married. So what did you see your future as being in as a married couple at that stage? Did you have any aspirations isn't really the word I'm looking for, but did you have some idea of what you wanted out of life? Did you see you still, even though you didn't think you'd done the right thing, did you still consider that you were staying with him and that you would make a go at life?
I had always wanted to have children. But you know, you don't need to be married to have children, but it was more kind of picking a bloke that would be an appropriate father.
And he certainly sounds as though he would be
if I, you know, wanted to do it. And because he had a lot of political understanding, you know, that was really good. You know, I saw us as effectively being political activists together.
Yeah. you can actually see a future. Did you want to have children like quickly or because you were only young, so that was just more of a long-term aim in your life.
Yeah, because I've always I've spent a lot of time with kids in my life and I like them. So, and not everybody does, you know.
So what were those 4 years like? Were they comfortable enough?
I was actually doing a whole lot of stuff.
So you're still active in your own life.
But one of the things was I was still doing some study at university, and I was doing classical studies.
This is at Adelaide Uni?
Yep. And I had a particular interest, or it was one of those things where I finally found something that I just really connected with, and I did a whole lot of stuff on ancient Greek in particular and some ancient Roman art and architecture, which is sort of a bizarre thing to have found, but you know, a lot of my time at university I really spent playing table tennis and going on demonstrations and not paying a lot of attention and just doing enough to get by, whereas this was actually something where I wanted to know the stuff. You know, I roared through the books, did a whole lot of work. So at some stage I went on what was an archaeological trip to Greece and Italy, which is...
As part of your
summer
studies?
School. It was a summer school.
Right.
Wasn't part of the studies, but
you know, it was logically
sort of through
fitted
the
in, didn't it?
Classics right. department. And that was interesting for me because it was my first overseas trip. And also I sort of became aware that I was pretty well focused on, you know, everything up to about AD 40 and not much you know, later kind of thing. And, you know, I was pretty obsessed. And it was I had a fabulous time during this trip, although the sorts of people that go on a cheap student trip often aren't people who are actually as interested as I was in the actual archaeology. They were actually interested in going shopping in Florence, that sort of stuff. But... that was, having done that trip, that was a bit of an eye-opener on some levels and not on others. But when I came back, I can remember looking at Peter and thinking, yeah, why am I here? This is interesting. And certainly my parents, who obviously must have known me quite well, saw the fact that I went off on this trip on my own as a really bad thing to do when you're married, whereas I couldn't see what the problem was. But in fact, later on, I had a different focus in that Peter was working in the public service. And
had you left the public service by this
yes,
time?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, I had. And I was still there for a while, But he was starting to drink. He was drinking, nice middle class boy. He drank a glass of wine after work to turn into a human being, after being in the public service all day. And then after a while he was drinking more, and then he was drinking spirits. And so I decided that we were going on a holiday. And he took a year's leave without pay. And we travelled around Australia, and we had very little money. So we had very little money to buy alcohol, and my intention was to wean him off, which is what I did.
And was he aware of your intention? I mean, he was happy enough to take that year off and go on a very cheap holiday?
Yes and no. I mean, no, he wasn't actually aware. I mean, it wasn't as sort of cold-blooded as that, but that's essentially what I was doing because I couldn't see any other way to do it.
You obviously did care for him a great deal.
Oh, absolutely.
To try and do that.
Yeah. But I have to say, trying to wean an alcoholic off alcohol is a hard ask. He got there, but the process for me was just pretty soul destroying. But also at the end of our trip, well, it wasn't meant to be the end of our trip. We had spent quite a long time travelling around, and not particularly reading newspapers or even listening to the radio. And then one day we turned the radio on, and it was the day that John Kerr got rid of the Whitlam government. And we never even discussed it.
Where were you?
We were down the bottom of Western Australia near Albany, and we just packed up the car and started driving across the Nullarbor. And it was like this sort of weird biblical time, because there was this incredible thunderstorm going across the Nullarbor, and it was raining like mad, and we were by far the highest metal object with sort of lightning crashing everywhere. And then when we got to Port Augusta, the weather changed and this huge red dust storm came out of the north. And we felt quite, it was like we hadn't been interacting with the world much, and it was sort of like suddenly everything, you know, was going pear-shaped. And when we got into Adelaide, I was sort of expecting to see tanks in the streets. It was that bad. And it almost was that bad then, really, wasn't it? But for him in particular, as a Labor Party person, you know, this was sort of a really monumental event. And So
what did you do when you got back? I mean, it was not quite the world ending, but it was sort of on that scale, wasn't it?
It seemed like that, and certainly with, I remember listening on the radio to a guy in the military who suddenly out of the blue started saying that the Australian army wouldn't be used against the Australian people. And what that meant was that he'd been asked. That's what was interesting. You know, and we'd been living out in the bush in little fairyland for ages, and you're sort of going, this is like really, really bad. So it felt very peculiar, and we found somewhere to stay, somewhere near Anzac Highway, so I kept waking up in the night hearing sirens and things. It just seemed really weird. And then we sort of...
What did Peter do? Because, as you said, he was so involved with the ALP. What did he do when he got back?
Well, he just immediately clicked in with his Labor Party people. And, you knew that with the election that Fraser was going to get in, basically, and the Labor Party people would be rolled. But, it was interesting to watch that whole process and see, you know, think about the level of media control that there is in Australia and that there was then, because really it was about newspaper owners deciding who was going to be the government.
What did you think about the way Bob Hawke handled it from the ACTU? Because he was telling everyone to be calm and to just settle down, whereas everybody wanted to go out and attack tanks if that was the case.
Yes, I think that was a mistake, but Bob's always been on the right of the Labor Party.
But was that a surprise for you? Because most people probably expected people to be rallying around and doing something.
No, but I mean, you know, it's hard to know what a sensible thing would have been to do any different to then.
Because if he hadn't done that, maybe they would have rioted. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the way he would perhaps rationalise it.
Yeah. And of course, a horrible thing, as a working class person, a horrible thing about it was that John Kerr had done it. You know, I mean, traitor. And no wonder he got hounded for years. And in fact, when... The first public appearance that John Kerr made, which was, because he was basically out of sight for about a year, was at Loxton in South Australia. And I can't remember, he was opening something. And he had a problem with alcohol. That's interesting.
Well, I mean, the classic one was when he presented the winning cup to the Melbourne the Melbourne Cup and was so drunk and the whole place booed him. I mean, he never recovered from that.
Yeah.
His public behaviour for that dismissal hounded him till his grave, didn't it?
That's right. Well, at this thing in Loxton, it was interesting because his first public appearance, it was kind of obviously picked to be an easy one because it's out of, in rural South Australia. And me and Peter drove there. And I can remember...
Because he was going.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I was going to be saying something. Me and Peter drove there, and on the way we had to stop because we realised that, like, there were police everywhere checking people and stopping cars, and we realised that one of our lights wasn't working properly, so Peter did this sort of quick solder job in the middle so we could sort of get through. And then when we got to the oval where it was, there were... I'm not sure how many hundred police there were, but it was boggling. Like, there were at least 200 people, police in uniforms, and there were zillions of police not in uniforms. There was the local Heritage Society who had 22 rifles and some sort of banner, mad as cut snakes. And there were also people there that I kind of vaguely recognised and that I knew were there as protesters, but everybody was too scared to do anything.
So contingents had gone up from Adelaide and other towns? And
well,
like
presumably, But it was more like individuals, actually. And then at some point I thought, this is totally mad. And there were millions of media people there because it was his first thing. And I had like an A4 sheet of paper and I wrote Sat Kerr on it. Put it in my pocket because we wouldn't be able to get away with having anything more than that. And at some point, I just held up this piece of paper. This is when he was going past. I held up this piece of paper and it was really scary because of all the police and these nutcases with rifles. But in actual fact, in another sense, it was actually very safe because there were so many media people there, And Peter was standing behind me. And this woman was trying to hit me with her umbrella, saying, "You hooligan," whatever, like holding up a sign saying, "Sat Kerr means I'm a hooligan." And a zillion, media people were taking pictures of me. But
I was the only person that
did anything. That's what was really scary. You sort of think, oh, how easily we all sort of, intimidated. It was horrible. But, they're the sort of things I did with Peter, which was good. Yeah.
So when did you decide don't want to be married anymore?
I was sort of back at work. I was working in the Department of Finance at that stage. And at some point I just realised I was just going downhill, and it was not right for me at all. And he knew. I mean, he had known too that I was always going to leave, but he hadn't sort of said it quite like that.
And accepting of it?
Yes and no. The first thing he said when I said I was going to leave was that he was going to start drinking. And then he realised that he'd said that. So I don't think he did, but I don't know. And, and what was interesting is I was working in the Department of Finance there and the women I worked with didn't believe that I had a husband that did his own washing and cooked half the meals. Like, they just didn't believe it. And then when finally I said that we were splitting up, they all said, "How could you do that? He does his own washing and he cooks up meals." As if kind of like
that's a good enough reason. Yeah.
And it may have, well, certainly for some women it would be a good enough reason, but it wasn't good enough for me. But I still didn't really have an inkling.
You just thought the marriage isn't working. Was that it?
Yeah, that's right.
So what happened? You were still in the share house or you moved on from there?
No,
what were your living circumstances?
I think at that stage we were actually living together, but I moved into a share house where I started.
So you moved out?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I was looking after.
So how did the two families respond to that? Clearly instigated by you?
My parents were pretty bad about it and Peter's parents were probably relieved.
Because they didn't like you anyway.
Yeah. No, on the surface they said, you know, it was a bad idea. But in actual fact, they they were happy. Whatever.
And had you discussed having children in that time? Because you said that was something you did want to do. Did he want to have children?
Yes, but we didn't.
And was he sort of same age as you, sort of thing? So it was very early to even really be talking that far ahead, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. And then I actually went straight from that circumstance to living with a friend of mine who had terrible postnatal depression, where I ended up mothering her children for a number of years. So it was sort of like I went from the marriage to motherhood, except they weren't my kids.
But that would have been an experience you probably enjoyed.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Loved them. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so when did you discover that you weren't heterosexual?
Well, it wasn't like you discover it one day. I guess that doing a whole lot of stuff, perhaps you do, I don't know.
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm asking, because as you said, it wasn't something you knew about growing up, whereas a child growing up today would probably realise relatively early on. And you've said you counsel people in those situations, which we might talk about a bit later.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
That's the only word I could think to describe it, because you're by that stage you're a woman in your mid to late 20s.
Yeah.
So it sounded to me as though perhaps it was a discovery.
Yeah, I mean, I came out when I was 28, so there was a bit of a gap. And a few more boyfriends and things,
So you did have a few more boyfriends?
Yeah.
Casually, like nothing?
Checking things out.
I should ask a very blunt question. What was your sex life like with the blokes?
Okay.
I mean, that's a fair question to ask, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, in a way, yes, but it was sort of all right, but, you know, wasn't that interesting.
Also, a lot of women in the 50s didn't have high expectations of a sex life.
Absolutely, that's right.
Because marriage was actually what was drummed into you as a child. And I certainly remember so-called sex education classes at school. It was much more making the happy family and learning how to cook and things like that. That was the only aspects that were really ever discussed. So you didn't have a high expectation of anything else.
Well, in fact, I'd have to say at the time that probably most women's expectation of sex was pretty negative.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So
we met those needs.
So that wasn't a clue, really, one way or the other. So I went through sort of various other boyfriends. And, some of them were perfectly nice and some of them were hopeless and all the rest of it.
Normal
it was like
life,
anybody, yeah. But more importantly... And I've still got the motorcycle and that kind of stuff. More importantly, I was kind of getting more political understanding, and a whole lot of feminist thinking is about what marriage means and is about how men and women relate. And that was all kind of happening while I'm going through these things. And also while I was looking after my friends' kids as well, because a whole lot of feminist theory is about motherhood and what happens to you and whatever.
And so this was a good experience for you, looking at just young children, were they?
One was...
And so that further made you feel that you did eventually still want to have children? That was a comfortable experience for you?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, I find kids easy. And then one of the things I got involved with about that time was the Unemployed Workers Union. And in the Unemployed Workers Union, me and some other women formed the Unemployed Women's Union, which is
a logical option, isn't it?
That's right.
Was that more of a lobby group, was it, or what was it? I do recall it being there, but I don't know anything about it.
We certainly did lobby about things. We created a newspaper. And we did a lot of, the Unemployed Workers Union did a lot of advocacy for unemployed people and pensioners to simply get their rights really from Social Security. So some of what we were doing was, needling the powers that be so people actually got their actual entitlements. Plus there were various other people that just simply didn't fit into the system one way or the other and trying to figure out, how you get someone a new identity when they don't know who they are anymore, that sort of stuff. So some quite complicated things. But I was doing a lot of stuff to do with women and unemployment and looking at things from those sort of angles.
And that would have fitted in with just your general activities and political beliefs anyway, wouldn't it? It would have been a fairly logical progression to work with that.
And then at that stage... It was then I actually started working at the Women's Liberation Centre doing abortion counselling and pregnancy testing and just answering the phone effectively, which was You know, in those days, there just simply wasn't any other kind of service like that. And it was seen as a terribly radical, you know, full-on kind of thing. In actual fact, you know, people would ring up and you'd talk about whatever it was, and that was it. But it
the concept was probably still radical.
Absolutely. Mm. And certainly helping anybody who'd been raped was seen as a really radical thing. And in fact, there was a lot of quite solid opposition from both government and all sorts of groups to helping women who'd been raped, which was...
After all, it was their fault? Was that still part of the public perception?
Yes, and of course women, certainly married women, were still the possessions of men.
So they couldn't possibly be raped.
At that stage, rape in marriage wasn't...
It was legal, wasn't it, effectively?
Yeah, it was legal, that's right. So, and for a lot of women wouldn't even have described what I would call rape as rape, because they were married and it was their husband, you know, who was abusing them. So, yeah. So my kind of, you know, thinking is developing. As I'm doing more and more stuff with Women's Liberation, I'm spending more time with women. And at that time it was, I started to live in women-only households. That was described as separatism. And these days when people use that word, they often mean lesbian separatism. But then separatism was simply living in a house together. And with those households of women, I guess I was more in contact with women who were either bisexual or starting to define themselves as lesbians. At that stage, lesbian feminist thinking was that any woman could be a lesbian, and there were women who defined themselves as lesbians who actually didn't necessarily have a sexual interest in women, but who wanted to live a life without men.
Okay.
So they may have been heterosexual or bisexual or whatever. It was
interesting times.
Yeah. And after a lot of kind of stuff and living with in households of women, you know, it starts to dawn on me, you know.
Very open to some of those ideas.
That's right, yeah. And it also made sense of some things that I'd felt in the past but not really understood about myself, yeah.
So really those noticing things and listening to what other people, that you realised that you were a lesbian.
Yeah, that's right.
And what sort of revelation was that to you? Because it really, I mean, it's not an easy thing to acknowledge, is it?
Yes and no. I mean, it was quite gradual for me personally, although, you know, I chose a particular time to come out, per
and
se.
How did you choose, and what were those circumstances?
It was my motorcycle again.
It keeps coming back, doesn't it?
No, I rode my motorcycle to Melbourne for a particular conference, and it was called Women, Patriarchy and the Future. At that conference, and when I rode to the conference on my motorcycle, again, I didn't have a lot of money, I didn't have leathers and whatever, and it was freezing. I was so cold that I stopped shivering, like it was that cold, you know, when it's actually being dangerous. Anyway, I go to this conference, and it was an absolutely astonishing conference, and talking with meeting lots of amazing women and discussing a whole lot of interesting feminist and lesbian feminist theory and whatever. Anyway, I came out at that conference and I decided that coming out must improve your circulation, because on the way home I wasn't cold at all on my motorcycle.
So tell me what coming out meant to you at that conference. What did you actually do?
It meant that I was in a group of women and we were talking about whatever it was, and I said, you know, that I now define myself as a lesbian.
And it was that simple for you to
It was that simple, yeah. Yeah.
And so you felt warm going home, did you?
Absolutely. I can remember riding my motorcycle and the sun was coming up in my rear view mirrors, and the moon was, you know, going
was
down.
Was it a case of you thought you'd finally found yourself, who you really were? Was there was it that defining in your life?
The first time I kissed a woman with desire, it was like I felt a whole lot of baggage just fall off, you know? Aside from feeling, you know, that kind of desire that intensely. But even though at that time in particular, and even now, that there is a whole lot of discrimination against lesbians, and in some ways that's a whole lot of baggage you acquire, I feel like it was just falling away.
So it was a totally life-defining experience? That's not overrating it?
That's not overrating it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you've... done what you should have done. Now you come to come back. You have to come back and face the real world of Adelaide and family and friends and work.
Yep, how
easy or difficult was that? You had a lot of time to think on the way back to Melbourne.
Yeah, I did. I was living in households of women, so
that part was easy.
That was easy.
Had they thought that you were anyone? A lot of people when they come out,
yes,
they say, "Oh, well, I knew that."
Yes, some people had, and some people were kind of just waiting for it. Yeah, but but some people were a bit surprised. And certainly a lot of the people I had been working with at the Women's Liberation Centre were lesbians. And
you knew that?
Mostly, yeah. And so they weren't that surprised.
So I'm guessing that environment was particularly accepting and it was no...
Yes,
not necessarily
a
great surprise.
No problem at all.
What about family? That's always the big issue, isn't it?
Well, it was really good because with my family, the first person that I wanted to tell was my sister, whom I'm closest to, and I thought about it, and I can't remember, I met her somewhere, and the person I'd sort of had a crush on at the time was a doctor, and I didn't know it, but my sister knew who she was. And so I went round to my sister and I said, I've decided I'm a lesbian, the person I really like is so-and-so. And she says, oh, she's really nice. She's got lovely skin. That's what she said. And I was stunned. And all my life, my sister had sent me up, and me and my boyfriends and whatever, by giving my boyfriends a mark out of 10. And and a lot of my
what
boyfriends
did you give your husband?
Hadn't got... No, he wasn't too bad. I think he was in the sort of sixes maybe. But some of my boyfriends had not rated very highly at all. They were still in the threes. And
obviously didn't have good bikes.
That's right. And what was really funny is because my sister knew who this person was, she immediately gave me a much higher mark than I'd ever had before. And I thought that was really funny because I hadn't been sure how my sister would respond. But she's never
so she responded perfectly, didn't she, really?
Yeah, that was fantastic. Yeah, yeah. And
was she surprised? Because you were very close to her, weren't you?
I don't think she was surprised. But I was the one that was the wild one and Rosalie was the good one. Like, so it wasn't.
So it was never going to be her, it would always be you.
Yeah, something like that.
What about your mum and dad?
I didn't come out to them then. I came out to them later when I sort of had thought about it more. And that proved to be a rather funny circumstance because they were both starting to lose their memory. Mm. And I came out to them and whatever, and the next time I went round, they'd forgotten. So here's something that's terribly, terribly important to me. And, they just wandered around the garden and,
so funny.
Okay, just change your headspace, Silver. This is stupid. Whatever, so I didn't bother. But they... even if they had sort of forgotten, they were they weren't as disapproving to some of my women lovers as they were some of the blokes, which is understandable. I think.
Well, you've had some three out of ten. They weren't that good.
My choices for partners certainly did improve.
So, how quickly were you introducing your new partners to your family? Not that long after you'd made come out?
No, it was a fair while before I had a partner.
Yeah, okay. But you felt quite comfortable taking them to your family and stuff?
Well, not about comfortable so much as, I was just going to, it was just going
to thing
happen.
To do.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, and they were just going to have to figure it out, yeah.
And your brothers?
My brothers weren't, it wasn't important to me to come out to them, and I probably technically haven't per se, but I've never made it.
Really, your sister was the one that you're closest to, and that's
She was the one that mattered.
And she clearly demonstrated that she understood, and there was no problem. Were there any people that it was a problem for?
Yes, at various times. I mean, I've had people spit at me and go a bit sort of troppo, but in general, most people it hasn't been an issue, Or if it has, they don't put it on you. I mean, I live in the country now. And
which is reasonably conservative in most areas,
yes,
isn't it? Where you are, certainly would be.
And we are both out there. Mind you, we're older women now, and so for some people, some people don't see older women as having a sexuality per se, and so...
Well, you're over 50, so you don't have a sex life. But yeah. There's also that perception that it's not an issue for older women, is it? In the same way that you would have been... Yeah. Had
it's
trouble.
Usually not an issue for women. It's
very rarely an issue for women.
It still sometimes is, but it's usually an issue for men. And a lot of men don't get it, that you don't want men as the centre of your life. You know, they expect to be the centre.
Well, they're used to it.
Yeah, that's right. And they just don't get it. So they think that you must hate them. You know, that's where the notion that lesbians are man-haters comes from. It's they still want to be the centre, they just want to be hated rather than to be irrelevant.
Yeah, and what about your partner? Tell me a little bit about her. Just being nosy.
My current partner?
Yeah. How long have you been together?
We've been together over 12 years. Must be about,
And she's always been a farmer?
No. Some of the time she's been...
Because farmer's not really a word I would have looked at to describe you.
No. Well, I live on a farm and I do
some
farming.
But you basically do most... she runs the farm and you help out sort of thing. Would that be a more accurate description?
Yeah. Well, basically I do the re-veg and she does the stuff to generate money.
What sort of property is it?
She grows wine grapes.
Oh, okay.
And we've got sheep. We've got Dorper sheep, which are a kind of... It's a specialist meat sheep that sheds its fleece. And they're good for Australia because they eat less fodder and they're very hardy. So you don't need to feed them things that you need to feed merinos.
It sounds as though you're at a pretty happy place in your life.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that must be a very nice feeling.
Yeah.
Now I've got a really strange question.
Yeah.
Did you ever catch up with your ex-husband?
Well, that's what I found difficult with him, because I wanted to remain friends with him, but he wanted me to be wife or nothing. And I found that very difficult.
So he couldn't cope with just being a friend?
No. And so basically I haven't seen or heard of him for many years.
Oh, just a curious question. I've assumed he was perhaps still in Adelaide and I was wondering if your paths did cross.
No. Yeah, so that's a blank there.
And just a nosy question, I think.
Mm. And that's one of the differences I see between heterosexual community and lesbian community. In the lesbian community, if you break up with someone, there's actually a strong push in the community that you maintain a friendship with them, and a lot of people will support you in maintaining a friendship with them.
And is that something you've managed to do quite well
with
ex-partners?
That's sort of the norm. Yes, yeah. Whereas in the heterosexual community, people often hate each other and, you know, are horrible to
each other. Become quite vindictive and nasty.
And so there's different processes that happen.
So is it simple to define the lesbian society in Adelaide? I mean, that's what you were saying, and I find that really hard to believe that there would just be this lesbian society rather than lots of organisations that you would cross over as in any situation. It's just the way you said that. I thought, that didn't sound right.
Well, I suppose one should more properly say there's a whole lot of lesbian communities. But when I was working, at one stage I did counselling for Lesbian Line, and people would ring up and we would, you know, chat, and people would want a connection into some part of the lesbian community. And that might be, they might be a sporty person, like there's lots of sporty dykes.
There's a lot of those walking groups and the hills and things,
sort of people.
There?
There's people that go on walks, you know, whatever.
And so they just wanted to link into those sort of things.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of different connections, yeah.
Do you think it's correct to say that a lot of men still don't think there are many lesbians around, that there are only just these few men haters around, without realising how big a part of society it is?
Well, the last stats I read in Australia, it's 1 in 10 for homosexuals.
That's right.
And the suggestion was it was 1 in 8 for lesbians for some reason. I don't understand.
Oh, I thought it was about the same percentage.
Yeah. No, it was
different. Because I knew the 1 in 10,
that may
that's
be
fairly
that
consistent.
Women are more likely to say than men. I don't know.
It might be that simple, that it's perhaps easier to come out if you're a female, and somehow that's a little bit more accepting.
Yeah.